You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
That when you are trying to impose oppression externally, you also have to impose it internally, because you cannot allow criticism in the United States.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of the show. We have a very special person with us today. Our guest is a poet, teacher, and freedom fighter. He has won the Paul Robeson and Langston Hughes Awards for his poetry. Our guest, Dennis Brutus, currently teaches African Studies and African Literature at the University of Pittsburgh. He is with us today to talk about South African apartheid, Iraq, and current social campaigns taking place in the U.S. and around the world. Hello, Dennis Brutus. How are you?
Hi there. I'm fine and good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, too. I guess one place we could begin is your involvement against globalization. It's my understanding you have participated in recent struggles like the WTO battle in Seattle and the World Social Forum in Mumbai, India. Do you think you could share with us some of your experience in this movement? In particular, your experience in Mumbai at the World Social Forum?
Right. I'm glad to start with that, because I think it may well be the most important political development in the world today, because it is a global movement. Seattle was important as one of the major points where we developed the anti-corporate globalization movement, and in replacing it with a grassroots globalization movement. I was also in Porto Alegre, and as you say, I was in Mumbai, which used to be called Bombay, earlier this year. And it seems to me the most hopeful movement in the entire world at the present time, because it's happening all over the world. As you know, we had about 11 million people marching in February last year against the war, against the occupation of Iraq, and we are planning another one for March 20 of this year, very soon, in the next 2 weeks, and it's all coming together. And one other point I need to make is that people are saying that we really have to create a different kind of a world, a more humane world, in which this whole notion that the bottom line is the most important thing and putting profits before people, that has got to stop, and we are in the business of changing the world. So I'm very glad and I'm very optimistic about it.
In addition to the development of a global movement like the World Social Forum, what kind of independent struggles can be traced to this larger movement?
We have a struggle in Haiti going on, which is really a power grab, an attempt to impose a coup on the people of Haiti. And of course we have the struggle going on in Venezuela, where you had an attempted coup, which the people beat back, and now they're trying to develop another coup, and the signs are not good at present. Wherever there is a challenge which represents the people versus dictators or the corporations or the U.S. military, they of course cannot tolerate these challenges, because they represent the reverse of what the corporations and the military-industrial complex is trying to achieve. So in each case, and you know, I've just been watching some video, a documentary of McNamara in Vietnam, and how they used the argument of the domino theory. You had to beat back the people in Vietnam, otherwise liberation struggle would spread to other countries. So there's always this fear that where people have succeeded in resisting oppression, those people are an inspiration. And so you have to try and destroy that resistance. But overall, I think the resistance is developing globally, all over the world. And that's the good thing. And each of the individual national struggles has a place in the global struggle.
I have a couple of questions regarding South African apartheid. First, didn't many U.S. officials in power today contribute to the apartheid? And next, I guess, what has resulted given the so-called end of apartheid?
You know, without the support that the U.S. military, the U.S. corporations, the U.S. intelligence supplied, sometimes directly, sometimes through Israel, that support was what kept the apartheid regime in power for a long time when it would have collapsed. So we are aware in South Africa, and as you know, I spent time in prison with Nelson Mandela and Governor Mbeki, the father of Thabo Mbeki. We spent time in prison, but we understood that the minority apartheid regime could only remain in power because it was being given support from outside, particularly, of course, by Britain, the British banks, Barclays Bank, Standard Bank, the U.S. banks like Chase Manhattan, but also the major U.S. corporations. So we knew that our struggle was against more than simply the oppression on the ground, the national oppression. Sadly, as you may know, and we may want to get into this, having succeeded in the stage where we managed to overthrow the apartheid regime, and by the way, as I'm sure you know, students and activists in the United States helped us in that struggle. But when we had succeeded in that phase, we were then confronted with a new phase, because at the end of the Cold War, you had the IMF and the World Bank writing the global corporate agenda, and unfortunately, the South African government under Thabo Mbeki moving from being a pro-people's government to being a pro-corporate government. They had a policy called redistribution and development. And they abandoned that policy, and they adopted instead a policy called GEAR, which stood for G-E-A-R, Growth and Employment and Redistribution, which was really a kind of structural adjustment program, the same program that the World Bank had imposed on Chile, on Argentina, on Honduras, and Ecuador, and Ghana, and Kenya, Zimbabwe. The South Africans are trapped in the same policy, with this difference that whereas other countries had the SAP, Structural Adjustment Program, imposed on them by the World Bank and the IMF, in the case of South Africa, and I hate to admit this, the South African government itself offered to collaborate with the World Bank and the IMF. And that's why we have this massive division between the rich and the poor in South Africa now. So we now have global apartheid instead of domestic apartheid.
You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. Our guest today is poet, teacher, and freedom fighter Dennis Brutus. He has been speaking about the social and economic conditions following apartheid in South Africa. The results of global apartheid taking place in South Africa seem to, maybe in a minor way, mirror the economic situation in the United States. For example, your mention of structural adjustment programs and the polarization of wealth seem to reflect some of the economic situations taking place here. With this in mind, how does global apartheid influence the United States?
The people, the Wolfowitzes and the Cheneys and so on. Not only do we have them collaborating with apartheid, but of course they were doing the same mischief in other parts of the world. Whether it was in Nicaragua, where they were supporting the Contras, you know, and others of them who were working the whole case of Iran and the support there. So these are people with a long record of being on the side of oppression and being themselves the agents of oppression. And this is really what is so scary. But one of the interesting things is, of course, that when you are trying to impose oppression externally, you also have to impose it internally, because you cannot allow criticism in the United States. And so we have under Ashcroft a steady destruction of civil rights in the United States at the same time that there is an attack on the economy, particularly as far as it concerns the states and the way the individual states are taking care of social services, education, health, transfer, schools. All of these are suffering, and instead you have $87 billion going for the military, going into the occupation of Iraq, even going into surveillance in the United States. So you have not only oppression externally, but you have to combine it with oppression internally.
I'm glad you brought up the current occupation of Iraq. What are some of your thoughts on the current occupation?
I want to just focus on one point, and to me this is the most important point, but we may not agree on it. It seems to me the most dangerous thing that is happening in our time, particularly in relation to Iraq, is that the United Nations, which is supposed to be a kind of world parliament, is a collaborator in the process of making the U.S. war, the U.S. invasion, the U.S. occupation legitimate. It is the United Nations which is legitimizing what happened in Iraq and saying, well, you know, the United States is in charge, and when the United States says they're ready for elections, that's fine. When the United States says, oh, they now have a constitution, we will accept this. And so this is a very dangerous process, and I've been trying to warn people about it, because there are even people who are radicals, friends and allies, the people who worked with me in Seattle 1999 when we took on the WTO and we defeated them, people from the Institute for Policy Studies and other radical think tank groups who are saying, well, you know, we have to hang on to the UN because the UN is our only hope. And I'm saying that's rubbish. We are going to have to challenge the UN and say, either you are a representative of the people and a forum for the people, or you are stooging for George Bush and his bunch of thugs, and we deny you legitimacy because you are conferring legitimacy on these so-called crusaders, the new war, the new global terrorists of our time. Just to take it one step further, I have to point out that right now the United Nations is also engaged through Kofi Annan, who is stooging for the U.S. Through Kofi Annan, they are getting ready to legitimize the coup in Haiti. A member of the United Nations Development Program is actually serving as one of a kind of a triumvirate or a troika being set up in Haiti to arrange that a bunch of murderers can take power in Haiti. And that transition is being backed by the United Nations, and the United Nations is giving it legitimacy. And I think one way to challenge this, and I hope people will support it, I believe we should rally all over this country demanding an investigation of what happened in Haiti. There should be meetings or rallies in every city in the country. And in addition, everybody should be demanding that Aristide should be brought to the United Nations and let him address the world and tell them what happened, because Colin Powell was directly involved in planning this coup. He was dealing with the people in the corporations politicians who are active in Haiti and actually discussing with them even before the coup took place. So let me just sum up by saying, one, I think we should challenge the role of the UN in Iraq, and two, we should challenge the role of the UN in Haiti, and we should demand that Aristide should be heard before the UN. That's my view.
You're listening to People's Tribune Radio. Our guest today, Dennis Brutus, is a professor of African Studies and African Literature at the University of Pittsburgh. He has been speaking to us today about the role of the United Nations in Iraq and Haiti. Dennis Brutus, if we could, I was hoping to return to South Africa to discuss a monthly review article by Patrick Bond. In this article, he claims racial apartheid was replaced by class apartheid through systemic cultural, political, and economic processes. Do you think you could take a moment to comment on this understanding of apartheid?
Well, yes, I'd be glad to. And I have to tell you that I regard Patrick Bond as one of the most perceptive critics and commentators on what is going on in South Africa. And I encourage people to read him. He also has an excellent book called Against Global Apartheid, in which he looks at the similarities between South Africa and what's happening globally. And of course, he is right on target when he says that in South Africa, systematically, there has been the destruction of even the little that the poor had. And on the other hand, enormous wealth and power going to the multinational corporations, both those that are inside South Africa and those that, while they are based outside South Africa, are still exploiting the resources of South Africa. For example, Anglo-American Corporation, which of course is also De Beers, the corporation extracting diamonds and gold from South Africa. But what is surprising and shocking is that we now have a black government which was elected by the people, and particularly through the support of the trade unions, COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions. And that government now steadily depriving the workers and the poor of their protection and denying them water, denying them electricity, denying them transport, taxing them at the same time that it's reducing taxes on the rich. And so we have, perhaps in South Africa at present, the most glaring example of the corporate process of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And the additional danger, if I can go on for just one moment, is that South Africa now sees itself as the platform for the corporate penetration of the whole continent of Africa. So that not only are people exploited in South Africa for the benefit of the corporations, but the corporations that are based in South Africa are now moving into the rest of the continent. And if you want specifics about that, I recommend that you look at Patrick Bond's work, but especially to look at a policy developed recently called NEPAD, N-E-P-A-D, which is supposed to be the New Partnership for African Development. It's a program which, in fact, will dictate to the whole of Africa that if you want to be accepted, you have to follow the dictates of the World Bank and the IMF. And if you refuse to follow the World Bank and the IMF, you will be punished and you will be starved of capital, you will be starved of investment, and only those who collaborate with the World Bank will be rewarded. So South Africa is taking the lead, not only within South Africa of imposing SAPs, but it's actually going to collaborate with World Bank in penetrating the rest of Africa. And I'd like to add just one final note on this. When George Bush came to Pretoria last year, and I was there at the time, he said in public that Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, is his point man. I'm quoting now. He referred to Mbeki as his point man. And the day after they met, Mbeki flew from Pretoria to Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, to meet with the new Organization of Africa. It used to be called the OAU, Organization of African Unity. It's been changed. It's now called the AU, the African Union. So Mbeki could go from Pretoria to Maputo and say to the heads of state of other African countries, I have been appointed by George Bush as the point man for Africa. And this just tells you how dangerous things have become.
You talked a little about the role of the World Bank within Africa. I think I saw on the internet that their birthday is coming up in April. And in addition to that, actions are being organized to counter their birthday events. What events will you be participating in this April 2004?
In April, the World Bank and the IMF will be celebrating their 60th birthday. And no doubt there will be festivities in Washington. They were formed 60 years ago in a little town called Bretton Woods up in New Hampshire. But when they have their birthday party, we are planning to have an unbirthday party in Washington. And we are going to demonstrate in the streets of Washington and declare it's time to shut the World Bank down. It's time to shut the IMF down. They have been around for 60 years. 60 years is enough. It's time for them to retire. And I will be there participating in the demonstrations. So that's going to be important, but I want to mention something else that's quite new, and I'm glad to have this opportunity to mention it. In May, in New York, on the 8th of May, we are going to be having a tribunal which will look at the war crimes of the United States and the acts of terrorism that have been performed by the United States government, by the United States military. So there's going to be a tribunal in New York on May 8th on the question of war crimes. I have been invited just today to serve on that jury, and I am very pleased to serve on this jury. I have served on other juries before. I served on a jury related to the death penalty and particularly the question of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I was in Vieques, and I served on a tribunal there when we were examining the guilt of the United States military on the island of Vieques in Puerto Rico. And I'm glad to say that our activities there have had some effect. Now we are going to have a series of tribunals. One will be in Istanbul, one will be in Hiroshima, one will be in Manila, I believe, one will be in London, possibly one in Paris, and one in Rome. But we are going to have a series of tribunals where we are going to examine the guilt of the United States government and the guilt of the United States military and the acts of terrorism which they have performed. And I hope these will be crimes against humanity. I hope that people all over the United States will support us in our activities.
Well, I'm sure many people will be looking forward to the upcoming tribunals. If people want to find out more about the worldwide tribunals taking place May 8, 2004, check out the website www.worldtribunal.org. That again is www.worldtribunal.org. Unfortunately, we are about out of time, and Dennis Brutus, I was hoping if you could share with us a quick poem before you left us.
If you don't mind, I'm going to read an early poem, but it kind of speaks about all my poetry. And it was written before I went to prison in South Africa, or maybe afterwards. I'm trying to sum up what all my poetry is about, and it's from a collection called A Simple Lust. And the lust I'm talking about is the lust or the desire for freedom of people in the ghettos and in prison in South Africa. A simple lust is all my woe, the thin thread of agony that runs through the reins after the flesh is overspent. In overtaxing acts of love, only I speak the other's woe, those congealed in concrete or rotting in rusted ghetto shacks. Only I speak their wordless woe, their unarticulated simple lust.
Thank you so much, Dennis Brutus, for being on the show, and good luck to you.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Well, that ends another edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society that nurtures the peaceful, equal, and full development of all people. If you would like to purchase this CD or our other print and media resources, you may do so by calling 1-800-691-6888. That number once again is 1-800-691-6888. Also, check out our website for PTR or maybe view some of our speakers to talk at your next event. The website is www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, I want to thank you for tuning in to People's Tribune Radio. As we close this program, we leave you with the voice of Dennis Brutus and a portion of one of his poems.
A gull gliding against a silver glary autumn sky sees a vast miasma of greed slowly encompass our entire planet, cries out to unheeding stars, to whom wails of children rise in shrill, unending caterwauls. And gull breasts with buckling wing, fierce gusts of questions, strives, resists against questions, slowly droops against questions, succumbs, twisting against questions, submits to extinction. Questions.